quote. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Africa Now. Today's show features On Fanon with Kenya Organic Intellectuals, Part 1. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Muizo Muntali. The music in the background is Colonial Mentality by Fela Kuti. At this critical time for the African world, and also this year being the year in which we commemorate the centenary birthdays of freedom fighters Malcolm X, Patrice Lumumba, Medgar Evers, and Frantz Fanon, Africa Now will continue to reflect on Pan-Africanism and liberation with a series of programs. Thus, a few months ago, there was a reflection on Fanon. Then, as part of WPFW's special Malcolm X's 100th birthday commemoration on May 19, and WPFW's special Patrice Lumumba's 100th birthday commemoration on July 2nd, we featured a series of programs with the Kenya Organic Intellectuals Network. The shows focused on Malcolm X's and Patrice Lumumba's impact on the work of Kenya Organic Intellectuals Network. Continue our series with the Kenya Organic Intellectuals Network. Today we present part one of our discussion on Frantz Fanon's influence on its activist work. In part one of the conversation, we feature Nicholas Mwangi, a member of the Kenya Organic Intellectuals Network, and he's part of Ukombozi Library. The discussion explores the continuities in the movements in Kenya, from the struggle against colonial rule to speaking truth to power in post-independence Kenya. The conversation unpacks the effects of neocolonialism today in Kenya and the continent, and the unresolved issue of land forcibly taken away from indigenous communities during colonial rule. The discussion also looks at using Fanon's complete theory in practice in movements today. Here is Nicholas Mwangi in conversation with African Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope.
Thank you for taking the time to join us today, Nicholas. This is, of course, as part of a series and a collaboration between Africa World Now Project and the Kenyan Organic Intellectuals Network. Thank you for taking the time to join us. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you, James, for hosting us. Glad to participate on a very important year on a very important program. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. This year is, of course, it's the 100th year of a number of revolutionaries who have made a deep impact on the intellectual and the practice of folk who are engaged in grassroots work, international work, Pan-Africanism, you know, anti-colonialism, anti-capitalism. They've been very important. That is Fanon, of course, Malcolm, and also Lumumba, and also Medgar Evers, one of the radical revolutionaries who was gunned down here in the United States, gunned down in his driveway, Medgar Evers, that is. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, give a little introduction to our audience? Those of you, some people may recognize your name or recognize some of your writings because you have been writing, you have, you know, write for different outlets that are here in the United States on a number of these particular topics. Talk a little bit about who you are, what organizations you are connected with, and also talk a little bit about your politicization, how you became politicized. What was the moment or moments that informed your work that you're doing today?
Thank you. Need an important question. Now, my name is Nicholas Mwangi. I'm part of the Organic Intellectuals Network. I'm also part of Ukombozi Library here in Kenya, but largely also part of over social movements and progressive organizations here in Kenya. In terms of part of the Organic Intellectual Network, we have been doing numerous works and events over the last couple of years, and also been helping to edit some of the books that we release. We have done at least four books here on Kenya and Africa. The last one was Breaking which should be coming out this year. So last book, The Breaking of the Silence of NGOs in Africa, it is a build-up on an earlier work that written by Professor Issa Shivji on the silence on NGO discourse. Our current work that we are working on, a book that we are working on, is on a broader thematic on the crisis of capitalism in Africa. That should come out perhaps at, this year. Yes, that is part of the work that we're currently on, and that's me. Part of why I came to join the struggle for change. I was inspired by books. I was inspired by books a few years back. I came across three books. One was How Europe Underdeveloped Africa by Walter Rodney, and the other one was Decolonizing the Mind by Ngugi wa Thiong'o, who just passed away the other day. And the third one is a book called The Prison Notebook by Professor Maina Kinyati. Both Ngugi and Maina Kinyati were in the same movement in the 80s, an underground movement known as the December 12 movement. And they wrote these literatures that I came across years back that helped to shape me up, recruit me on this side of the struggle. So yeah, largely I've been shaped up by books and comrades and people who have also mentored me in this struggle. But the spark was me coming across a text by Rodney, and that's the How Europe Underdeveloped Africa.
Could you talk a little bit more about the December 12th movement? Because I think that is an important intervention in movements, particularly radical revolutionary and the continuity of radical and revolutionary movements in Kenya, but also in East Africa. So talk a little bit more about the December 12th movement for folk who may not be aware of it.
Sure. And the December 12th movement was an important movement. It's what the current struggles in Kenya have built on ideologically, because it's a movement that emerged in the late 70s in Kenya. First, it was a group of intellectuals within universities and other people in Kenya who were disillusioned with how independence had turned out to be. The fight for our struggle for the freedom of Kenya through the revolutionary movement, Mau Mau, were fighting for key things, land, food, and freedom. And afterwards, independence, they emerge a class of African elites who betrayed the fight and the fruits for independence. Thus, the December 12th movement emerges in that context to continue a struggle that had been waged earlier to fight for dignity, to fight for a dignified life for the Kenyan people. It was an ideological movement grounded in Marxist-Leninism, went on to up to 80s, Of course, they were heavily suppressed and detained during the Red Scare era and the ideological war and confrontation in the context of the Cold War, the Soviet and the U.S. And that movement was caught in between that. So most of their members were detained. And I've mentioned that book by Maina Kenyatta, Prison Notebook, has been part of it. Actually, it's a book that he wrote when he was in prison. That's why it was crucial. But yeah, it was the movement, the ground that all, most progressive organizations and movements contemporary have built on. And so it went on, being part of what we got, this, what we call here the second liberation that gave way to pro-democracy and multipartism. If you are aware of Kenyan history, you'll be familiar with those words. But largely it is work that they had done to raise political consciousness, to provide and fight for an alternative worldview to that of capitalism, to that of imperialism, to that that had emerged post-independence. So it's a movement that was confronting post-colonial realities of promises that were never kept, and they continued that struggle. Yeah.
No, thank you for that. And that's important in the context of, I think it's always important in the context of understanding continuities of intellectual and practical work, right? This becomes important for a historical consciousness that is important when we're engaged in movement work or when we're engaged in organizing our communities. And this is because in order to kind of fight for a particular future, we have to understand not only what we're fighting against, but also what we're fighting for. So we don't repeat same mistakes, right? So the idea is to study, deep engagement in the context of texts, but also how do those texts in a particular moment not necessarily fit directly to the current moment, but what are the continuities or what are some ways within which people can understand to address, you know, this long struggle, which brings us to Fanon, right? You know, France Fanon, again, revolutionary, someone who's been writing a lot, engaged in a lot of important work. You mentioned Decolonizing the Mind and Akin, you know, Ngugi wa Thiong'o, just passing, as you mentioned. He went to Martin O'Rodney. Of course, Fanon is in this particular conversation, I would say, as they're writing and thinking and engaged on work on the ground. So with that being said, how does France Fanon fit into the framework that you and your comrades are developing? What is it that we should be, or that you all are using as a framework, as a tool to understand the neocolonial conditions, but also at the same time, fight for a new society, a new world?
Sure. And, you know, indeed, it was Ngugi wa Thiong'o again, who said in a text that he wrote in 1986, it's called Writing Against Neocolonialism. And he puts Fanon there and he says that it was impossible to understand the writings of the 20th century concerning the liberation without reading Franz Fanon, and in particular his text, The Wretched of the Earth. And so Fanon remains one of the most radical and greatest theorists of decolonization and African liberation, for sure. And the books that I mentioned, you'll see the footnotes on Fanon. His works have been important because they have enabled us to dream of a new world, not only theoretically, but to combine the praxis, the theory, and the practice to this revolutionary change. But also his work, the catalog that Fanon produced, The Wretched of the Earth, the Dying Colonialism, provide us with crucial frameworks for understanding the revolutionary processes necessary for us to dismantle this colonial and neocolonial structure. But we also try to use Fanon in a correct manner, in a correct fashion, and not selectively pick part of it and part of his work and dismiss some of his work, because the other school of thoughts that also form part of the decoloniality processes that sometimes can use Fanon selectively. when the conditions favor it. For us, it's a revolutionary all through and through that demanded that whenever there's oppression, people must rise, that they must counter it, that state violence should not be excused. And so we not only read his psychoanalytic works or insights like The Black Skin, White Mask, but we also reiterate that his call for armed struggle, mass political education, and the demand for a new world, for a new society that continues, that is needed for today. So contextualizing him within Pan-Africanism, within our lived realities. And it's important now, especially, because we now have a resurgence of Pan-Africanism globally, but also there's contemporary geopolitical shifts and change that are happening in the world. So it's very timely to discuss Fanon at this point because of the developments that are happening. I'm sure you have heard of what is going on in the Sahel, fight for sovereignty, the Burkina Faso, Niger, and Mali. This is interesting. It is new for us to experience what is ongoing. And this is part of the rapture that Fanon also insisted and correctly said that Fanon calls for liberation through rapture, and that in this changing global order, especially where Africa is, we have gone for at least 60 years from the 1960s era of independence without too much change or major ruptures that have happened in the continent. The other ruptures that happened is like a decade ago in the Maghreb. So this is important to see what has happened in the Western Sahel area, but also the kind of protests that took place in Kenya last year is part of those build-ups or part of those ruptures that burst when a society has reached the level we have reached, the highest level of inequality, lack of a dignified life that we are all experiencing. In that sense, Fanon informs our struggle, and that we learn it must be ideologically grounded, of course, combined with the theory and practice, the theory being the intellectual mantle and work that leads the battle of ideas, as we contest that, because we all understand that knowledge production and information is not a neutral ground, and it's important to continue wage a battle of ideas on that front intellectually, but also translate that into practice, which is the praxis, and advance for us what we believe that is urgent and necessary now is African sovereignty in the 21st century. That is very key. It's very contemporary. It's what is happening. The demand that mines be nationalized, that land be given, land that we are fought for. And so it is very key, and in that sense, that Fanon has kept informing our works and organizing as movements here in Kenya at this point in time.
So I wanted to make a link, because, you know, this notion of decolonization and then decolonizing the mind and sovereignty are linked directly in the works of not only in Fanon, but in Gugiwati Dhiango, in the Land and Freedom Army. You know, land becomes an essential component. How do we understand that particular framework, right? The role of freeing the land, the role of land in freedom movements at the same time, the processes of decolonization, particularly those who have a certain relationship to land, meaning that they would want to use land for a get rich scheme. Like, how do we understand what the Land and Freedom Army were demanding in the context of decolonizing the mind, that processes of still ongoing decolonization, and also the relationship to sovereignty? I know these are big questions. If we had them figured out, I think, I think it'd be different. But I just want us to think about that in this particular section of the conversation. How do we understand that? Looking at the demands of the Land and Freedom Army, looking at what Ngugi wa Thiong'o was arguing at the same time, Fanon, decolonizing the mind, consciousness development, political education, and sovereignty. Can we just dive in at any point and what you're thinking about that?
It's important to understand the question of land was at the center of the struggle that was waged by the Kenya Land and Freedom Army here in Kenya, and largely everywhere in Africa. You'll notice that recently when South African President Ramaphosa visited the United States, there was that kind of confrontation and surprise from President Trump. It was the issue of land. And that has been a contested issue. And that's very similar. If you look at Kenya and South Africa, both countries were envisioned as settler colony. So we can relate, and most African countries can resonate with what is happening in South Africa, meaning that the structure, the neocolonial structure and economic model still persisted and was never changed. How the part of decolonization, and this question is key. When we want to get the land, we must tie it with decolonizing the system entirely and not selective. And because land is the means and mode of production for the survival of many people here in the continent and in the global south, largely land is very key. It is at the heart of survival. And that land question must be resolved. So it's very political. So and the colonization process must also be very political. It's not just purely an academic endeavor or a discourse. Just to engage with it at a high level. It must attempt to resolve the burning questions of our people, because people are it must resolve material questions that are key and important to people. But sometimes you find the question of land, because it's sensitive, it can be relegated deliberately by also decolonization scholars and activists, because it's always a very burning questions. Because how do you resolve the land question, for instance, in a capitalist system that we are in? Does decolonization favor a process where land is nationalized and people are given? That is what was being contested, debated with Trump and Ramaphosa. Because South Africa passed a bill, the expropriation of land without compensation. It can be done, yet though they have not done it. How does decolonization see that as a process? In my opinion, it's very hot and cold when it comes to the question of land, which is very key. How the process of acquiring and reacquiring land that initially belonged to African people sometimes is a scary question. But as we are in political movement, we are organized. People are in movements, are in organizations, trying to build and recover their dignity. And part of that dignity is getting that land to farm, to build, and everything. Of course, like you mentioned, you'll have people who want to benefit from the land. Yeah, yes, we are living in a capitalist system where private accumulation and private ownership is allowed, and it's there. But we must also say that that is a very small number of people who hold or own land or private property in Africa or in majority part of the world, especially when it comes to land.
You're listening to a conversation with Nicholas Mwangi, who is a member of the Kenya Organic Intellectuals Network and is part of Ukombozi Library. This conversation is part of our series with the Kenya Organic Intellectuals Network, and the series is highlighting the impact of freedom fighters Malcolm X, Patrice Lumumba, and Frantz Fanon. And as you know, this year, Malcolm X, Patrice Lumumba, Medgar Evers, and Frantz Fanon would have been 100 years old. Today's conversation is a discussion on Frantz Fanon's influence on the work of the Kenya Organic Intellectuals Network. Early on May 19th, we featured a conversation with the Kenya Organic Intellectuals Network looking at Malcolm X's influence on their work as we commemorated Malcolm X's birthday on that day. And on July 2nd, we featured a second conversation with the Kenya Organic Intellectuals Network on the day of Patrice Lumumba's 100th birthday, looking at Patrice Lumumba's impact on their work. Today we're focusing on Frantz Fanon's influence on the activist work because July 20 was Frantz Fanon's birthday, and he would have been 100 years old on July 20. The discussion explores the continuities in movements in Kenya, from the struggle against colonial rule to speaking truth to power in post-independence Kenya. The conversation unpacks the effects of neocolonialism today in Kenya and the continent, and the unresolved issue of land forcibly taken away from indigenous communities during colonial rule. The discussion also looks at using Frantz Fanon's complete theory in practice in movements today. The music in the background is Conundrum by Kasiva Mutua. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation with Nicholas Mwangi of the Kenya Organic Intellectuals Network.
You have a large number of squatters. You have a large number of people who do not own land in Kenya and in other parts of Africa. So it's very important to reconnect that land is indeed very crucial to our freedom. Without it, it is incomplete. And that's why from the December 12th movement that I mentioned, it's been a build-up. It's a continuous struggle of the same issues, of course, with other nuances of things that have emerged with time that are here and were not there during the 70s and 80s. But the land question has still remained a big question, a big demand for all those, for all generations. So it's very key. It's the end product of a genuine decolonizing process.
I wanted to talk a little bit about, because hopefully if folk are kind of listening intentionally to our conversation, what I'm really kind of hinting at, particularly when we're talking about the question of the land, this relationship between decolonization, neocolonialism, and anti-colonialism, is what Fanon talks about, this idea, and sovereignty, I should say. Fanon writes about pitfalls of nationalism, right? You know, national consciousness, I should say. This is a chapter three, The Pitfalls of National Consciousness, where he's kind of being very, very clear about the role of revolutionaries and how to construct a new society after engaging through armed struggle, particularly engaging through struggle, I should say, the colonizer. I'm very interested in your thoughts on this, because I'm thinking deeply about another dictum that Fanon talks about, or that he writes about in another chapter, where he talks about betraying the mission, right? He talks about discovering each generation must, out of relative obscurity, discover its mission, fulfill it, or betray it. Everyone, and it's interesting that you talk about how there's a tendency to apply Fanon in pragmatic terms, almost like just for the means, not just for the collective mean, but for individual means. Like you apply it not, Fanon is not applied fully or correctly, And I'm interested in this notion, this particularly because I've been thinking deeply about this, you know, Fernand mentioning this idea. And then I'm also was like, what if we think about the question of, are we on the verge of actually betraying a mission, and or do we understand the mission, right? And this is related directly to the relationship between decolonization, neocolonialism, and anti-colonialism. Decolonization is a process, of course. There's a phases of that. And then anti-colonialism can be roughly defined as a continued process of resistance to make sure that there isn't a recolonization. How do we fit? And I know I'm being heretical here. I know I'm thinking, you know, about this neocolonialism and neocolonialism that Nkrumah writes about, you know, this notion of a new colonialism that is being talked about. How do we understand the relationship between decolonialization or decolonialism, neocolonialism and anti-colonialism, and the fact that there are some in some instances, in some corners, who say that there hasn't been a post-colonial process? The colonial apparatus has not been truly removed. So are we still in that decolonial phase? And how do we reconcile the anti-colonial process at the same time? How does this look in relationship to the decolonial process? You know, please forgive me. I'm just trying to think through these particular things, and I'm trying to, you know, try to look at them through many different ways as possible to get some type of clarity in understanding how we approach as a African world community, these particular questions. And also, how do we develop sustained real camaraderie with you all in Kenya and Nairobi working, and us working here in the United States? How do we not just do a lot of talking, so to speak, this idea of sovereignty and, you know, this national consciousness? Hopefully I made sense in that question. You could dive in at any given point, say whatever you want. I know it's a lot. I'm just trying to think about these things in a way. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, a lot of thinking is always needed because, yeah, they're also complex questions. If they are easy, we would not have been discussing them. But you mentioned the pitfalls of national consciousness and whether that is the continuity or how we fail when you refer to Fanon Dictum on that each generation must find its mission, fulfill it or betray it. We have to agree on certain things that I think are obvious, even if they're going to be debated. We can agree that the post-colonial state has largely, the base has largely remained the same, but it has mutated also in terms of, you can speak of the aggressive neoliberal nature that has emerged, you know, in post 70s everywhere, and in Africa it has been worse. In Africa or the global south has a different relationship when it comes to that neoliberal nature or the imperialist relationship compared with the global northern, because of another factor like the IMF and World Bank, which has been catastrophic for countries in the global south. So systematically, things have mutated, but the base of that informs that that oppression, that inequality of why we struggle has largely remained the same, in my opinion. And Fanon critique on that chapter on the national consciousness, saying that there's a new class of ruling class and that has emerged on an independent nations like Kenya, which lacks that productive base. They are compradas, he calls them that, dependent on the former colonizers for capital, culture and market access. And that critic was at that time. Has that changed? Not at all. So that entire process of colonial continuous struggle is there because finance capital is now the most aggressive model of system, and the countries in the global south have remained that base where you can say where the wealth, that surplus value is extracted to sustain the north, but to sustain a very few people in the global north, as it's not a representation of the working class in Europe, or the ordinary person in Europe who live reality, could be almost same with any ordinary person living in any part of the world. So I see a mutation. We can speak of mutation in terms of what has happened in the post-colonial state. But how do we confront it? That's why I was talking of Sahel. Is it a new way of seeing things? Should we not be caught with textbook definition of what democracy looks like in every country? Because why we also organize in terms of fighting for a better world is also to get political power. And we understand how that political power is misused by few individuals to mortgage the future and the dignity of the many. And what is happening in Sahel is very interesting, not without contradictions and mistakes that are happening. Of course, these are popular coups that have taken place. I think it's important that in terms of that question, of final question on change and the rupture, that we look at what really is it happening, what that process is. It's key to informing us, and we make we can't foresee the totality of it as of now, where it will end, how it will, the transition process is. But for me, earlier you asked the question of land is very key. I've seen some of the mines being nationalized, saying that we are having a bad deal. This is purely extraction of wealth from Africa, from a few companies that are not paying taxes, that are not reciprocating the way it is required. So we are putting an end to such a deal. That to me is, in a sense, of is a very revolutionary move. It is a very revolutionary move that needs to be looked at very carefully. Try and inform part of our struggles. We are here, you're there. How do we connect? Because you're fighting for change in the material sense. And so, like you say, it's not just exchanging a discourse and debates, which are very important, but practically, what are we doing? What is being done? For me, if issues are systematic, then it means organizing, and it's a daily process. It cannot end. And why is it important today? It's very clear that fascism is on the rise. And so there's no time to looking back or putting or slowing down in terms of how the organizing is done in terms of movements, organization, progressive political parties, trade unions, all these cooperatives, all these must have a place of convergence at some point to wage a better battle and a counter to what is happening around the world that we don't agree with. I don't have straight answers to that. I've circled around it, but
yeah, it's one of those things. When we talk about the level of political education that is needed to raise one's consciousness to a critical consciousness, I think what is important is that we read intentionally and not read only, but study Fanon. We study Lumumba. We study, you know, the prison notebooks. We study them in a way where we're looking for the questions that they lead us to, right? The contours of their thought. And so I try to be in that particular space of having a clear understanding of what was said, what was written. At the same time, try to extract some of the questions that are trying to lead us to some of the, you know, advanced ideas such as recreating a new society, right? Interrogating concepts that we use, such as decoloniality, right? Interrogate them to decolonize decolonization, right? So, you know, how do we utilize the dialectical process to find the contradictions in in the words that are being used, or the theories that are being used, or the ideas that are being used, and their practicality. Right. So I think that that is, and then of course, we're living in a particular period where there is a rise in what is considered to be technological feudalism or techno-feudalism, where you have a large majority of big companies who are extracting the intellectual labor, who are extracting, you know, the way people are attempting to recreate their conditions and utilizing that against them, right? You have folk who are, we always celebrate people who create, you know, new soaps to heal or to address skin cancers, right? And they're coming from dire situations. We celebrate them not understanding, well, wait, this is a structural process that probably if we address those structural issues, the person or the people are living in, we could have gotten to that a long time ago, right? We could have addressed skin cancer. We could have addressed some of these things. So how do we look at techno-feudalism? How do we understand this notion of a neo-colonialism or a new colonialism and how technology has always been a part of that? We don't want to make the confusion that AI and technology today, because we know the resources that are being extracted from Kenya, from South Africa, from the Congo, from, you know, all over, including the intellectual resources become important. How do we understand technology? I guess it's a long way for me to kind of throw in another thing in here for us to think about, as well as the role of technology. How do we understand that this is very good use of technology? I'm talking to you, you're in Nairobi. I'm talking to you thinking about these big, you know, kind of questions that we're thinking about in our local conditions, but we're also trying to think about them together on a global, but technology is allowing us to do that. Again, another big question, again, we're not going to solve all of the issues today, but it's how we're thinking about this, I think, is important.
Yeah, it's important, but technology is key. And, but like any other thing, if it is still minority owned, it is, if it is still a monopoly of a few, it's like any production base, that it won't serve the majority in the best way that is it is needed. Of course, you could not, this is a personal opinion. I don't think you can reverse the wheels of history. Once certain breakthroughs in science and development have been made, and I believe in a society that moves forward. It's a society of progress, and we can trace that historically. But like anything, and you've called it techno-feudalism, or like anything under capitalism, if it is in the hands of a few, then the chances of it being a revolutionary breakthrough or scientific breakthrough is still limited to us. It is still very extractive. It is still very exploitative. You know, the entire minerals of the world come from Africa. One of the places in Africa, Congo, where key minerals that are manufacturing phones, that are manufacturing all electronics, where Facebook, where Apple get their materials, part of it is done by child labor. You know, by kids in territories that wars have been waged by rebels funded by multinational corporations to bring instability in these countries that provide the resource, the raw materials, the minerals to sustain these technological breakthroughs that you see around the world. Yet, if you were to go to Congo and see the lives of the people of Congo, or any other country where minerals are extracted, to the sustenance of this technology that we are using, it's a difference that cannot be imagined. Congo is one of the, or is can be considered one of the poorest nations in terms of how people live there, or even here in Kenya, or any other part in Africa. Yet 80% of these minerals are extracted here. So the exploitation process of minerals that feed into technology is still there. How technology then is controlled by multi corporations, by a few people, then there are things people are not able to control. We don't know what happens to the data. Yes, it's a good thing that me and you are communicating from afar based on, and this has been enabled by technology, but where does the data go? What happens to the data? We are now understanding algorithms and those sorts of things where corporates purchase this data to market things to you, almost social engineer things to you. So we can see that side of technology, but in a different kind of society. I think science and technology will do marvelous things, especially in health sector, in every kind of sectors, in food production. But again, this won't happen because things are still very commodified.
Just been listening to a conversation with a member of the Kenya Organic Intellectuals Network, Nicholas Mwangi, and he's also part of Ukombozi Library. This is part of a series with the Kenya Organic Intellectuals Network that we've been presenting the past few weeks. At this critical time for the African world, and also this year being the year in which we commemorate the centenary and birthdays of freedom fighters Malcolm X, Patrice Lumumba, Medgar Evers, and Frantz Fanon, Africa Now continues to reflect on Pan-Africanism and liberation with a series of programs. Thus, earlier, a few months ago, there was a reflection on Fanon. Then, as part of WPFW's special Malcolm X's 100th birthday commemoration on May 19th, and WPFW's special Patrice Lumumba's 100th birthday commemoration on July 2nd, we featured a show with the Kenya Organic Intellectuals Network. The shows focused on Malcolm X's and Patrice Lumumba's impact on their work. Continue our series with Kenya Organic Intellectuals Network. Today, we presented part one of our discussion on Frantz Fanon's influence on the organization's activist work. And we presented it today because July 20 would have been Frantz Fanon's 100th birthday. In part one of the conversation, we featured Nicholas Mwangi. As I mentioned, he's a member of the Kenya Organic Intellectuals Network, and he's also part of Ukombozi's library. The discussion explored the continuities in movements in Kenya from the struggle against colonial rule in speaking truth to power in post-independence Kenya. The conversation unpacked the effects of neocolonialism today in Kenya and the continent, and the unresolved issue of land forcibly taken away from indigenous communities during colonial rule. The discussion also looked at using Fanon complete theory in practice and movements today. The conversation with James Pope and Nicholas Mwangi will be available on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is You've Got to Have Freedom by Pharoah Sanders. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muiza Mutale. Up next is Headline News, followed by Sha'anana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, particularly looking at issues concerning Palestinians. And after that is the women's collective, Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by The Browder File with Tony Browder. And that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Combeat La Kai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X. formerly Twitter. That's at African Owl Online. Also, African Owl is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under African Owl Online on SoundCloud. That's African Owl Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to African Owl's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers Michael Nicella and Clea Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers Chanda Kolzer and Fona Ngonda, and our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdison. And thanks to our entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Thank You, Ja, by Rita Marley, commemorating her birthday, which is July 25th. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. House Speaker Mike Johnson is shutting down House operations early this week. Lawmakers are expected to vote on a few non-controversial bills today before taking a break until September. The move puts a pause on the Democrat-led push for legislation that would require the government to publicly release all documents related to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Johnson said he wants to give the White House space to release the information on its own. Democrats are accusing Republicans of trying to cover up the truth. Speaking at a press conference yesterday, Senator Cory Booker said that explains why House Republicans are leaving town.
They're running out of town because it's clear the speaker believes that their membership in the Republican caucus over there is so fragile that they cannot withstand simple debate, discussion about the topic of Jeffrey Epstein. That this is so patently a hill of lies upon which the Justice Department and House Republicans are trying to hide behind, that they can't stand to have debate and discussion about it, so they're canceling their plans and running out for a summer recess. That should tell voters something.
In more news, the humanitarian crisis in Gaza has only worsened since Israel launched its blockade of aid last March, leaving millions of Palestinians facing starvation. Gaza's health authority said today at least 10 people have died from starvation in the last 24 hours, bringing the toll from hunger to 111, including 80 children. Now, a coalition of international organizations says the blockade is also endangering the lives of doctors and aid workers. In a joint statement, more than 100 humanitarian groups, including Save the Children, Oxfam, and Doctors Without Borders, called on Israel to restore the full flow of food, clean water, and medical supplies to Gaza and agree to a ceasefire. The coalition warned that supplies were totally depleted and that their organizations were, quote, witnessing their own colleagues and partners waste away before their eyes, close quote. The letter blamed Israeli restrictions and massacres at aid distribution points. Also, international news agency Agence France-Presse announced plans to try and evacuate its remaining freelance staff from Gaza because they are starving and too weak to work. And in more news, an American citizen was one of those killed in clashes in southwestern Syria last week. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
Between its Sunni, Alawite, Druze, and other communities, Syria is an incredibly diverse country. But Syrian President al-Sharaa has had difficulty reining in his allies and stopping sectarian violence. Among those killed in last week's violence was Hassam Saraya, an American from Oklahoma who was visiting family. Saraya was identified by family members in a video circulated over the weekend, which showed armed extremists executing 8 members of the Saraya family. The extremists stormed the family's home and executed the male family members, leaving the woman behind. The extremists were likely Bedouin, another minority group, although many of them were wearing military uniforms. The chaos which has engulfed southern Syria